You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on kpfk.org, all major podcast apps, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and J.P. Morse, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldrich, co-host Carrie Kim, engineer Blake Lamkin, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
There isn't much room for optimism in these times. Our political system is mired in both corruption and a push towards dictatorship. While we're all watching the Trump regime trample the Constitution, the climate crisis isn't slowing down. But if there was ever a time for advocating for and believing in a better world, this is it. Wen Stevenson is a correspondent for The Nation, a frequent contributor to The Baffler, and a longtime grassroots activist. He's engaged in numerous campaigns of nonviolent direct action for the climate and climate justice. His first book, What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other, was about the early years of the U.S. climate justice movement. After staring into the abyss of the poly crisis, he's written a series of essays about how to respond. His new book is Learning to Live in the Dark. Wen, thanks for talking with me.
Hi, Marianne, and thank you.
First, let's start with how dark it is. What do you think are the biggest challenges we're facing right now?
Oh, wow. Where to begin? As I see it, it really comes down to two major catastrophes that are now converging, that have converged. And that is one being the planetary crisis, the climate catastrophe, and the other being our political catastrophe, certainly in this country, with the rise of Trump and MAGA, and now what we see is really something like fascism. So I wrote back in 2019 in an essay for The Nation that's in this book that the only thing worse than climate catastrophe is climate catastrophe plus fascism. And I'm afraid that's what we're looking at here, if not a full-blown fascist or totalitarian regime. We're certainly looking at a fascist movement and a federal government that is in the hands of a neo-fascist, quasi-fascist political movement. One of the major political forces behind Trump is the fossil fuel industry. And there's a term in the air these days called fossil fascism. In other words, the combination of the power of the fossil fuel industry with fascist political movements and regimes. And that's what we're staring at.
I thought it was really interesting that they declared themselves fascists by declaring war on Antifa, which is just short for anti-fascist. So if you're anti-fascist, you're saying, hey, I'm a fascist.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I was out there along with millions of other people on Saturday for the second No Kings protest nationwide here in Boston. I'm in the Boston area. My sign said, make America anti-fascist again. You know, which was a theme that we saw a lot on the signage. One of my favorites was my grandfather was an anti-fascist. He fought with Patton in World War II. The White House wants us to believe that it is somehow anti-American now to be anti-fascist. That's why they tried to somehow, absurdly label the No Kings protest as the Hate America rally, right? Okay, so we're anti-fascist. That means we hate America?
And then what was incredible was the videos that both J.D. Vance and President Trump put on the internet where the president was in a jet dumping sewage on the protesters. And J.D. Vance had him being crowned a king. Oh, and in the jet, Trump is wearing a crown. So I don't think you could get two more anti-American videos. And they're so open about it.
It's as if they're mocking all of us by saying, okay, you want to call me a king? Call me a fascist? I'll show you fascist. This is where we are. It's at a level of absurdity, but also a level of seriousness and real life and death, flesh and blood reality. I know you air in Portland area.
Oh, yes. The news this morning that the Ninth Circuit Court has said it's okay to put the National Guard in Portland, despite the fact that the police, the mayor, the governor, everybody's saying, no, it's fine.
What's happening, what has happened and is now still happening in Los Angeles, what's happening in Portland, what's ongoing right now in Chicago. Let's make no mistake, this is the climate crisis, okay? This is one manifestation of the climate crisis. And it is exactly what I'm talking about when I say that our climate and political catastrophes have converged. It's what I'm talking about when I say climate catastrophe plus fascism. For decades, people have been writing about and warning that climate change can and will and now is creating kinds of social instability and political instability that can give rise to fascist responses. And what is driving what's happening in LA and Portland and Chicago and other places, of course, parts of this country, all over the country, is immigration. And what is one of the things driving immigration and migration globally, including here in the U.S., but the conditions on this planet, the droughts, the untenable conditions under which people are having to live, which includes, again, not just the ecological catastrophes, the storms, the floods, the droughts, the fires, but the political conditions that those then can exacerbate or lead to. So, yeah.
There's a push to start calling this a soft civil war. And that's what it's starting to feel like. In your book, you quote Hannah Arendt. She said, "Never has our future been more unpredictable. Never have we depended so much on political forces that cannot be trusted to follow the rules of common sense and self-interest, forces that look like sheer insanity if judged by the standards of other centuries." That could have been written yesterday, but she wrote that in 1951. Why was she so pessimistic then, and what can we learn from her now?
Yeah, it's great. I'm so glad that you quoted that and point to Hannah Arendt. I should probably explain that the reason I wrote this book, the reason I started writing this series of essays, started thinking about Arendt and other mid-20th century anti-fascist, anti-totalitarian thinkers, people like Arendt, Albert Camus, Simone Weil, and many others, but they're some of the ones in the book, around that time, 2016, 2017, with the first election of Trump. It was a very, very dark moment, as you may recall. It's now surreal that it's even darker now. But I went into really something like a deep, deep depression, and I was questioning how to go on. As an activist, as a writer, I'd committed myself to this fight, to this struggle, and it really looked like we were facing the abyss. And so, reaching for an author like Hannah Arendt, of course, who wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism and Eichmann in Jerusalem, and was one of the great political philosophers of the 20th century, she helped me look into the abyss. Few have done it better and more productively than Hannah Arendt. And for her, it was personal. As I point out at the beginning of that essay, my essay on Arendt is called Learning to Live in the Dark. It's the title essay of the book. And I decided to try and read Arendt in the context of Trump and the climate crisis, these converging catastrophes. One of the things I realized and appealed to me about her is not just her thinking, but her personal experience. It was personal for her. She was a German Jewish refugee. She narrowly escaped from Nazi Germany in 1933. She was one of those millions of stateless human beings, refugees, who had nowhere to go. And she just very luckily escaped from Europe and made it to America in 1941. So when you ask, why was she so pessimistic there at the beginning of The Origins of Totalitarianism? Well, I mean, one word, Auschwitz, right? But not only that, she was writing about this moment when she and her generation had just been through two devastating world wars, cataclysmic, an economic collapse in the Great Depression, revolutions, this surge of statelessness and refugee crisis, and the rise of totalitarianism. And then by 1951, when she wrote that, we now had nuclear weapons. We had seen Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the Cold War had begun. So we are not the first people to look into the abyss. And in fact, what I was trying to point out there is that it's easy for me to say that and kind of, you know, cynically laugh about it. But, you know, unfortunately, most people, I think, today still don't even think of the climate crisis, certainly within mainstream media, mainstream political discourse, whatever, as an abyss on the same level as the mid-20th century. But anyone who has been studying this, or anyone who has ever really listened to a climate scientist, knows that it has all the potential for, in some ways, an even greater abyss.
Because we're not addressing it. It's continuing, it's gaining momentum, and in a lot of ways, all of the political shenanigans of the Trump regime is taking away from the seriousness that people should be focusing on the climate crisis.
It's important to note there that Trump is not simply distracting us from the climate crisis. He and his administration are actively doing everything they can to dismantle the progress. It's never been a lot of progress, mind you, but to dismantle what progress has been made, especially under Biden and Biden's legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, which of course was the biggest and most sweeping climate legislation in this country's history, which is to say it was the only sweeping serious climate legislation that Congress has ever passed. But Trump is actively rolling it back. That might have something to do with the fact that he held a dinner for the leaders of the fossil fuel industry during the 2024 campaign and asked them to give him $1 billion, and then he would do whatever they wanted him to do. I don't know if they raised $1 billion for him, but I know it was a lot of money, and this is exactly what we're seeing. Not that it was any surprise,
And the thing about that quote where she says, they cannot be trusted to follow the rules of common sense and self-interest. This is the thing that always baffles me, is these people are all going to have to live on the planet while it burns. And yet there's Trump canceling all of the solar and wind projects.
Pulling us out of the international negotiations, right? This is a global issue. And the United States is still the world's largest economy. And let's remember, thanks to Barack Obama and Joe Biden, it's also the largest producer of an exporter of fossil fuels. So we've had that contradiction going for us now for quite some time. And on a global level, climate crisis cannot be addressed any other way than on a global level. Trump is taking the U.S. completely out of the game. Now, at the same time, China, which is now becoming the global leader on, and is far and away the global leader on renewable energy, and Europe, together with Europe, the world is moving ahead, trying to move ahead, and will move ahead without the United States. But it's going to be that much harder to address a climate catastrophe without the U.S. participating, and with the U.S. continuing to put the pedal to the metal on in terms of accelerating fossil fuel extraction, the expansion of new fossil fuel projects all over the world. This is what we're seeing. It isn't merely a distraction from, it is an active fight, declaration of war on the part of Trump and his administration and the fossil fuel industry against the rest of the world when it comes to climate.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is Wen Stevenson, and we're talking about his book, Learning to Live in the Dark, Essays in a Time of Catastrophe. Well, he keeps saying that it's all a hoax, and he's built this fictitious world where forces are conspiring to, I don't know what, sell electric cars? It doesn't make sense. Another one of Arendt's observation was that totalitarian movements require a fictitious world and have, quote, a conspicuous disdain for the whole texture of reality, unquote. We certainly see that with the Trump regime. Why is that? Why this fiction?
Right. Well, I also want to point out that, or just explain that one of the things I learned from reading and rereading Arendt's work on totalitarianism is I wanted to try to understand. Part of looking into the abyss was wanting to understand what kind of a mindset could, with full knowledge, continue to double down on fossil fuels and the expansion of a business model that is literally destroying the conditions for human life and civilization on this planet. And Arendt's description of the totalitarian mindset, her phrase, the totalitarian mindset, really helped me come to grips with that. Because let's be clear, Trump and the fossil fuel industry, they understand what they're doing. They know the science. In fact, major fossil fuel corporations like ExxonMobil, their own internal scientists were telling them what would happen if we continued with business as usual. Way back in the 80s or earlier, even in the 70s, they knew where this was heading. And yet here we are still in 2025, and it's still full speed ahead. So what kind of a mindset can do that? As you say, they and their children and grandchildren have to live on this planet too. One of the things that Arendt identified as part of that totalitarian mindset, in addition to its need to create this fictitious world, to turn reality on its head, to create a reality to fit their ideological worldview, Or as Orwell, his famous 2 + 2 = 5 in 1984. You have to go along. You have to be able to say that 2 + 2 = 5 and pretend like you believe it. What's really driving this is, first of all, a belief that power can be unlimited, that there are no limits to power, that anything is possible, and that everything is permitted in the pursuit of complete domination, the system. And in order to do that, your fellow human beings have to be rendered, as Arendt put it, superfluous. Basically, the entire populations of human beings, or as Arendt put it in her unfortunately gendered language of the mid-50s, men, not man, but not the abstract man, but men, individuals, individual human beings, become superfluous, meaning they are not useful or relevant. They are disposable when it comes to this pursuit of total power, total domination. What are the actions of the fossil fuel, fossil fascist regime, if not an effort at total global domination? They know and are actively trying to subject every human being on the planet to these catastrophic conditions of global warming. It's inescapable.
Yeah, you think they're doing this purposefully and they knowingly?
I think they're doing it knowingly. I don't think they set out to destroy the planet, okay? What I think, but what I think is abundantly clear is that they are knowingly and willfully pursuing a course of action that will lead to the decimation of and the suffering and death of countless hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, mostly in the global south, among the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet. And they're doing it, I would say, heedlessly, recklessly, heedlessly, in the pursuit of nothing but sheer profit and power.
One of the things that has been really disturbing is watching Trump basically dismantle the government. He's been firing people and ripping apart agencies. But if we're going to have a real change that will make a difference in the climate crisis, we have to have some fundamental changes in the way we live, in the way that we look at our place in the world. Do you think there's a possibility that all of the destruction Trump is doing will actually make it easier to have that sort of revolution? I think a lot of people are stepping back and saying, there was a lot of things that we needed to change, and now that he's taken a steamroller to it, maybe it will actually hasten a new way of looking at things.
That is certainly one way of looking at it, and it's something that a lot of theorists of social change and of certainly of revolution have pointed to historically. I write at the end of the book that in a chapter called The Desperate of the Earth, which is playing off of Frantz Fanon's classic book on anti-colonial third world revolutions called The Wretched of the Earth, I float the idea at the end of the book that the climate justice struggle, which includes our present political struggle just to defeat fascism, by the way. We're never going to have climate justice if we don't first defeat fascism. The movement, the fight, will never be what I would call radical enough or fearless enough, strong enough, until enough people are desperate enough. Because it's only when people historically have been truly desperate that they've been willing to lay everything on the line, to risk, to take large risks, and to really risk their lives and so on.
Do you think that addressing the climate crisis also has to include climate justice? Are the two inseparable?
Put it this way, there won't be any justice if we don't address the climate part. Okay, because full-on climate breakdown, climate and ecological breakdown, is going to create conditions in which we won't be able to. It's the mother of all injustices in some ways. And yet, a lot of us feel and have been arguing for years now that we won't really be able to build the kind of mass movement that's needed to change the politics around climate if it doesn't include social and economic justice. A movement of comfortable, educated, and relatively well-off white folks, and not just white folks, obviously, but you know, I'm being a little, you know, flipped there, but you know, isn't going to be a truly mass movement. So if we're going to build a bottom-up working class mass movement to counter the right-wing populism that we see now, it's going to have to engage and build broad coalitions with all the other social movements that are fighting for justice in this country and around the world.
What do you see as the difference between being a climate doomer and a fatalist?
Right. Well, I get into this a bit in a couple different essays in the book. And I would say if you're truly a doomer, then you are a fatalist. You've already decided that it's over. There is nothing left to be done. So the end has been written and is now inevitable. Okay. That's certainly not me. Although many of us are adamant that we have to face reality, though. We have to face the desperate situation that we're in. Otherwise, we'll never take the kind of action that's required. There's another kind of denial, climate denial in a way, not denial of the science, but a denial of what's actually required in order to address the climate crisis in a meaningful way. That means literally getting rid of the fossil fuel industry. That means no more fossil fuels by the middle of this century. I mean, look, the IPCC, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, made very crystal clear this is the world body of climate scientists, thousands of scientists concurring on this, that if we're going to get on a path to zero emissions by mid-century, which is what has long been determined would be necessary if we're going to avert the worst impacts of climate change. And that is actively being looked at and revised all the time. It may be that we need to do it sooner than 2050 at this point, because the longer we go, the more emissions are in the atmosphere and the worse and harder the problem gets. But they were very clear in their 2018 special report on 1.5 degrees Celsius warming above the pre-industrial average and what the difference would be between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. So 2 degrees had always been the red line, the internationally agreed upon limit that we were shooting for, but people were increasingly, especially in the developing world, pointing out that even at 1.5 degrees Celsius, the impacts will be so catastrophic for so many people that we have to try to limit it to 1.5. And they determined, they were quite clear, and experts all around the world have concurred with this, that we would need to cut global carbon emissions, greenhouse emissions, not just carbon, in half by 2030.
We don't even seem to be able to stop the growth of carbon emissions,
exactly.
Let alone cut them. It doesn't even seem possible this is going to happen.
Actually, I want to point people to another book, the new book by Bill McKibben called Here Comes the Sun. Bill's a longtime comrade of mine, and just, you know, full disclosure, but Bill's writing about, and has been writing about now for quite a few years in The New Yorker and elsewhere, about the truly revolutionary advances being made now in renewable energy, especially solar and battery technology. And it is expanding. Renewable energy, solar especially, is expanding so fast now. The price of solar has dropped so far. And the advances in battery technology, the large-scale battery energy storage technology, which is absolutely crucial to making solar and wind work at grid scale, has advanced so far. We can now say that it is technically and economically possible to do what needs to be done.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Wen Stevenson, and we've been talking about his new book, Learning to Live in the Dark. Wen, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. as the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time, presents By the Dawn's Early Light by Lawrence Block.
This is a case that shouldn't be in the first place, and I'd love to clear it up before they even go so far as presenting a bill to the grand jury.
So for me, you want?
Whatever you can find, Matt. I don't know what there is to be found. But you were a cop, and now you're a private. You can get down on the streets and nose around.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. Gremlin Times 3D radio players present an adaptation of Lawrence Block's short story, By the Dawn's Early Light, right here on Community Radio KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Suavemente, bésame, que quiero sentir tus labios besándome otra vez. Suavemente, bésame.